This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Edward Villella is one of the most acclaimed American male dancers of our time. Dance critic Arlene Croce wrote, "The Villella repertory is the greatest corpus of ballets created for a male dancer in this century." Yet Villella broke a lot of the popular stereotypes of ballet dancers. He was a New Yorker from an Italian-American working-class family, and he was a college welterweight champion. Villella joined the New York City Ballet in 1957, and in 1960 became a principal dancer under George Balanchine's direction. Villella's TV appearances spread his fame beyond the dance world. Now Villella is carrying on the Balanchine tradition as the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet. He sustained many injuries during his career as a dancer, back trouble, bad knees, 9 broken toes, and stress fractures on each shin. When he retired from dancing, he had a hip replacement. I asked him if he thought this was an uncommon number of injuries.
Well, it might be more typical of people of my generation, and people of my generation who were principal dancers functioning, for instance, in live television. In live television, we danced only on cement stages.
Mm-hmm.
The cameras in those days were so enormous that you couldn't have a wooden or soft floor. You had to have cement.
Wait. The cameras were so enormous that you needed...
Were so heavy.
Oh, of course. You needed the cement floor to support it.
To support the weight of those enormous instruments. Now, of course, the miniaturization of electronics has allowed these cameras to be much smaller. And you can put them on wooden floors and linoleum-covered wooden floors.
And you were known especially for your leaps and jumps, so you'd land hard, I guess.
The landings were the devastations. I broke 9 toes on cement in television in those early days. But I was also a person within the New York City Ballet who had the great fortune to dance most of that repertoire. And I would do 2, 3, 4 ballets a night. Also, I was at a time when there were not that many bravura male dancers, so I was called upon to do an awful lot of that stuff. Plus, I just loved dancing, and I found it hard to say no. I just danced everywhere and anywhere.
When you had your hip replacement surgery, was that still in its experimental stages, and were you worried about it? Were you warned against it at the time?
Well, when that occurred to me, there was I considered a very primitive operation, and I was told that it had a life expectancy of 16 years, and it was really designed for much older people. And I was 40 years old at the time, and I just didn't think that that was a good idea. And I said that to my doctor, and I said, I believe in medical science, and I'm going to wait this out. And he said, well, you may not be able to handle the pain, because it's the equivalent, or so I was told, of a broken bone. So it was 24-hour pain. And for 5 1/4 years, I didn't sleep 2 hours back to back. But I decided I was just going to deal with that and wait for a new operation. After 4 years, a new operation occurred. I then said to my doctor, I would wait 1 more year and let them get version 2 of this operation, because anything new certainly is improved after a year's time. And I now have a version 2 of the operation I had 10 years ago. And I am very happy to say it still serves me very well. And don't tell my doctor, but I abuse it.
How do you abuse it?
Well, I jump up and down on it. You know, it's not the kind of thing that you should challenge. I mean, it allows you to walk and run and lead a normal life, but it really is not designed to be demonstrating entrechassis and double air tours and things like that. And I somehow can't help myself. I know I shouldn't do it, but it's what my life is about is moving, and I find it very difficult not to move. But at any rate, since that operation, there is now an even more contemporary one that is highly, highly successful.
But you wouldn't want to go through that again.
I would prefer not to.
Right. Edward Villella is my guest. I was just watching a clip of you performing on the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm not sure what year it's from, but I think we can assume it's from probably the early 60s or something. And so you do this fabulous dance. I'm not sure who the ballerina you were dancing with was. Then Sullivan comes out after the performance is over, and he says, beautiful dancing, Edward Villella, where are you from? And you say, Bayside, Long Island. And you laugh, and he laughs. And he asks the ballerina, where are you from? And she says, Teaneck, New Jersey. And everybody's hysterical. What's so funny about that?
I'm amused by it now myself.
I think that in those early days, people expected you to be from France or Italy or the Soviet Union, or you couldn't be American, good heavens, to be a classical ballet dancer. I think people simply Europeanized in their minds the stereotypical person. So I think that that was one of the first indications that we're unaccustomed to this. This is a very, very young art form in this country. And thank heavens for the New York City Ballet and George Balanchine and people like Jerome Robbins, who Americanized classicism. When Balanchine went with the New York City Ballet for the first time to the Soviet Union in 1962, some of the officials there said, well, welcome back to the land of classicism. And Balanchine said, no, classicism now lives in America. So we now have, lo these many years, a true American classicism, which is now international. It is the new classicism, which really is showing us the way.
So you no longer would be laughed at from being at Bayside.
No, I think it's not quite as amusing as it used to be.
Right. You were from an Italian-American family.
Yes.
Was that considered even more unusual?
Oh, extraordinarily. My father was somewhat taken aback by this whole thing. He really was a somewhat backward-looking Italian-American. And my mother was the forward-looking person. And you have to understand that it wasn't only that art and classicism and ballet were an oddity in any Italian family, but a young boy, that was a totally different and new concept. And as a matter of fact, I danced only because my sister was dancing.
Yes, this story is part of ballet folklore now, I think. Why don't you tell the story about how you started dancing?
Well, my mother was an orphan, and she loved to dance and never had the opportunity. So when she had a daughter, she thought that that was a way that she might vicariously touch this. And she used to take my sister off to a local ballet school in Queens. And I used to hang out in the streets and get into physical trouble. I was just a very physical kid. Until one day I got knocked unconscious by a baseball and dragged home by my friends unconscious. And my mother was away with my sister. And she said, from that time on, I needed to go to my sister's school because she couldn't trust me on the streets anymore. And there were 40 giggling girls and mothers and me. And I was bored to tears, and I couldn't sit still. And then they started to jump. And I went in the back of the room and started to jump with them. And I disrupted the class, and the teacher said she would only allow me to stay if I joined. And I was humiliated, but I was made to do it. And then in 6 months' time, I began to love what this stuff was. I was very physical, and I did all of those sandlot athletics and so on. But this was so much beyond it. I mean, it had such depth, it had development, it had structure, it had form, it had music, it had a physical language that you could speak with your body, and all of that made a great deal of sense to me, and I loved it. I went for about 5 or 6 years till I was about 16. My sister quit. I was made to quit. My father decided I should go to a military school. I'm a graduate of
Make you a real man.
Right. So I'm a graduate of the New York State Maritime College. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in Marine Transportation.
Did you have to hide from your fellow students at the maritime school that you loved ballet and that you danced ballet?
No, because I was also a welterweight boxing champion.
So you could take care of them, right?
I could speak a physical language.
So your parents didn't want you to dance professionally.
No.
They put you into the maritime college. You were there for 4 years, and you got back into ballet afterwards. How did you get back in?
Well, in my last year, I decided, frustration aside, I needed to move forward and do what I wanted to do, and I started going into the city, to New York City, and started taking some classes. And after I got myself into some kind of shape, I presented myself to Balanchine, and he offered me a job. And when I graduated, I told my parents this, and they basically didn't speak to me for about a year. But
I sent them tickets to our opening night of the second season that I was with in New York City Ballet, and they expected to find it difficult to find me in the back line. However, there were four ballets on that evening, and I had three principal roles. And at the end of the evening, they were standing in the wings in tears, and the three of us stood on the stage laughing, hugging, and crying. And from that time on, my father became a balletomane. He ran a trucking business in the garment center, so he didn't really have that aesthetic background to understand what I was doing. But from that time on, I mean, he used to hand my pictures out in the garment center in my reviews.
What was he initially so worried about in terms of a career in dance? Was it the difficulty of making a living in dance, or was it how was I going to explain to my friends that my son is a ballet dancer?
I think he was more practical, and he thought mm-hmm. that at that time, in particular, it wasn't a good and easy living.
Yeah.
You know, the New York City Ballet maybe worked about 5 or 6 months, 6 or 7 months a year at that time, and the salaries were not extraordinary. So it didn't make for a very, very bright financial future. So I think he was very concerned about that. He said, you know, you'll break an ankle, and then what do? You need an education. And I'm delighted he felt that way, and my mother felt that way.
So he was very concerned about how you'd make a living in dance. You've been described as one of the first American male ballet dancers to really make quite a living at dance. I mean, did you feel compelled to prove that you could do it, that was possible because of your parents' reaction?
Yeah, possibly. First of all, I thought we all worked very hard and we weren't paid very well. I also thought that other people, other than Americans, who were talented and wonderful, who might be compatible with us, were making so much more money than we. And I determined that was something I, for myself, but also for other dancers, and for the entire American dance field, would try to raise the producers' financial appreciation of American dancers. So I started to do things like insist on top of the show, on the Ed Sullivan Show or Kraft Music Hall or Bell Telephone Hour or any of those other things. I used to do a lot of symphony dates, and I would insist on being paid at a level commensurate with the number of people in the audience. I would dance with the Cleveland Symphony, and there would be 8,000 people out there, and a famous opera singer had been there the week before, and there were 4,000. And this opera singer was probably making 2 or 3 times what I was making, and at the intermission, they were inviting me back already. And I said, fine, but you must understand the economics of this now. And I just thought it was very important. I thought it was important that Americans started to appreciate the level of their own.
You've also been credited with opening up the role of the male dancer in ballet. Were there certain frustrations that you felt when you started dancing in the role of partnering, which is what so many men have so often been consigned to in ballet?
I was a disastrous partner when first started dancing, because I stopped when I was just about 16, which is the time when you learn how to partner.
Right, this is you stopped to go to the Maritime College.
Right.
Yeah.
So I never had any partnering experience, and I was so incredibly naive and so full of this passion to dance. When I came back, I just threw myself into it, and I didn't think about the intricacies. I didn't think about the inside understanding of the musicalities, and et cetera, and I certainly didn't think about partnering. I thought, well, you just grab them, pick them up, and put them down. That's all you have to do. And I'm strong. I'm an athlete. I won my letters in baseball. I'm a boxing champion. That's all I have to do. I can get them up. And it unfortunately for those ballerinas that I had to dance with in those first 3 years, I basically learned how to partner on them in front of 2 or 3,000 people a night. And it was terrible for those poor ladies.
What would they tell you after a performance?
Nothing. They'd be running away in tears.
Oh, gee.
It was awful. And I apologize to them publicly right now. I'm sorry.
So did that have to do with your developing jumps and leaps and bravura moves? Was that not partnering, but was that more of where you felt you fit in?
Well, you know, I had I had a natural ability to jump. Mm-hmm. I had a natural ability to do the pyrotechnical things. I was a very athletic kind of person, dancer, whatever. And the natural instinct is to do what you do best, and you go towards that. And it was devastating for me to understand that it wasn't just this bouncing up and down on a stage. There was much more to it. There was a whole artistry to everything, including partnering, and just a presence on stage and style and characterization and relationships and all of those things. So once I had gotten back, I thought, well, that's it. That's when you start to learn, is when the curtain goes up. And fortunately for me, it became another passion, and that was to learn stagecraft.
You danced for many years for Balanchine. You were a principal, a star of the New York City Ballet. But from what I understand, you never really got that close to him, as close as some of the other dancers did. Why not?
Well, it was not in my nature to pursue inner circle. That simply was not what I was or what I was about. The other part of it was that when I did come back, and I found after a year or two that I really didn't know what I was doing and that I was damaging my muscles and my muscle tones and I was creating injury, I needed something else. And I began to analyze the technique, and I began to analyze the Balanchinian approach to it, and I began to understand that it wasn't just me who was hurting and complaining about the Balanchine classes. Everybody would do it, but they wouldn't admit it to Balanchine.
What do you think was wrong with the Balanchine technique in his classes and in the way he taught?
There was nothing wrong in what he gave. It was how he gave it. He was impatient. He would sometimes give 12, 14, 16 minutes at the bar. A normal bar is 30 to 40 minutes. So there's a slower pace, there's a build. He wasn't interested in building. My assumption is that he thought everybody came warmed up to class, that you would work 20 or 30 minutes before you came to his class. And I tried that. But you see, we were dancing 8 times a week, and me in particular doing 3-4 ballets a night. It was very, very difficult to get to the studio half an hour early to prepare in the morning when you'd just gotten off stage at 11 o'clock the night before. It was physically impossible to do. And I knew it. I knew that there was going to be difficulty, but I knew it was the only way I could survive.
Edward Villela is my guest. He was a star of the New York City Ballet, one of the best-known American male ballet dancers. He's now the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, one of the most acclaimed of the regional ballet companies in the States. You were married in 1962. This has been described as almost a landmark event in the world of ballet because it helped dispel the notion that every male ballet dancer was a homosexual. how do you feel when people describe your marriage that way?
They just didn't know my marriage. Which was somewhat tumultuous and ended in divorce. I am since married a second time. Well, I certainly didn't get married to prove that not all male classical ballet dancers are homosexuals. A lot of that stuff, that I was an example for American male dancers and all of that, it sounds as though I was on a crusade. I really wasn't. I was more on a crusade for the art form, for the ability to progress this wonderful thing. I mean, I just loved it. I happened to be an athlete who also was a classical ballet dancer. I happened to be a New York Italian American kid from the streets. I happened to be all of that, and it just fit with the emergence of American classical dancing that I was emerging, and I began to personify this new American way to function and to move. In addition to that, I was this guy who really liked women, and I was this guy who used to be a boxer and play baseball and had Sandlot experience and stuff like that. It just happened that way, and naturally, I became this curiosity. and the press would be fascinated with it. And it started to mushroom and just evolve and develop. And I'm very happy it did. I'm truly glad it did, because it started to humanize this art form. And I think some of my colleagues even today, and certainly some of those people in the late 50s and early 60s, had a different approach. There was a grandness about it. There was a posturing about it, and I thought it was important to dispel that. That was 19th century, and it was also European and Soviet. And we were Americans. We were Fred Astaire's. We were the new classicism.
You know, we had talked about how you were helping to show that Americans could be classical ballet dancers. In your company, the Miami City Ballet, I think about a third of the dancers are Hispanic. Is this the next frontier to prove that blacks and Hispanics and people from around the world are capable of dancing ballet?
You know, it's sort of silly when you analyze it and think about it. I mean, human beings are human beings.
Right.
And there are certain human beings, it doesn't matter where they are from, who have abilities and talents. And that's all we seek. We seek talent. And for us right now, from where we are positioned in Miami, there are a lot of Hispanics there, and Miami attracts a lot of Hispanics. So we use what's available, we use what's there, and we begin to find out that Argentina produces some wonderful dances. We found out that Venezuela produces some wonderful dances. Colombia produced some wonderful dancers. So we also have people from Europe, from Italy, from Germany, and we have an Australian. We also have a lot of Americans. I would like Americans who were born in America. And in a funny way, it's been more than interesting. I've been able to find dancers. I have two, possibly three, things that I look for in a dancer. Number one is a quality of movement. And the second most important thing to me is if that quality of movement can then physicalize music. So those are the two things that I look for, and I think that those two things are talents, whereas a lot of my colleagues, other artistic directors, will be looking at full-blown technical ability. Now, my perception is that you can't teach talent, but you can teach technique to talent. So that's what I try to find. I try to find talented people who don't yet have a full technique, and I prefer to do it slower, to take 2 to 3 years to get this kind of Balanchinian sense of quickness and passing through balance and off-balance kind of stuff into them.
Edward Villela, he's the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which begins its fifth season this September. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.